From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. For more than 25 years, Pulitzer Prize-winning newspaper columnist Mike Royko has been explaining his native Chicago to the world and vice versa. On this edition of Fresh Air, Royko tells us what he learned about the city growing up in his father's tavern. Jacques d'Amboise was in a New York City street gang when he started dancing. After his long career as a principal with the New York City Ballet, he decided to introduce kids to dancing, hoping it could change their lives like it changed his. Coming up, teaching kids to dance. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent recording of works by British composer Sir Michael Tippett. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the latest animal movie, The Bear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. Former Housing and Urban Development Secretary Samuel Pierce, who refused to answer questions at a congressional hearing last month, said today he will invoke his constitutional right against self-incrimination and refuse to testify at sessions scheduled for tomorrow and next week. The refusal by Pierce and three other former top HUD officials to testify has brought the six-month-old congressional investigation to an almost complete stop. The panel has heard from dozens of developers, consultants, and attorneys who did business with the department about mismanagement and political favoritism during Pierce's tenure. Little testimony has been given, however, from high-level agency officials. More wrangling today on Capitol Hill about a capital gains tax cut. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Getting a capital gains tax cut was one of George Bush's campaign promises, and he hasn't given up trying to get one passed by Congress. A capital gains cut has already passed the House. It was a temporary measure for just 2 years to tax the profits of assets like stocks or real estate at a lower rate than other income. Democrats unsuccessfully argued against that proposal, saying it was a tax cut for the rich. They proposed an alternative, a tax cut on individual retirement accounts, or IRAs. Now Republicans in the Senate have crafted a package that incorporates both proposals, a tax cut for IRAs and capital gains. That has forced the Democrats to change their argument. They now complain that the Republican proposal will add to the deficit. Republicans say they will try to attach their capital gains proposal to whatever legislation they can. Their latest try was to attach it to the Polish aid bill, but they need 60 votes to do that, and they concede they don't have those numbers yet. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady said today that extra safeguards are needed to calm the stock markets when trading is volatile. Speaking before the Senate Banking Committee, Brady said the safeguards should include authority for the Securities and Exchange Commission to halt trading if necessary. The situation is quiet in suburban Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, at the scene of yesterday's prison riot at the Camp Hill State Correctional Institution. Mara Gabriel from member station WITF has this report.
The Camp Hill facility remains in a lockdown status following Wednesday's riot in which 44 people were injured and four prison buildings were damaged by fire. Superintendent Robert Freeman says staff members are trying to assess damage and bring prison operations back to normal.
The staff are going about their business. The institution is locked down. The inmates are getting fed. They're getting their medications. Staff are out talking to them, and basically it's just very quiet.
The Camp Hill prison is seriously overcrowded. It's housing 800 inmates over capacity. But Freeman says it's too early to tell if the crowded conditions helped fuel the uprising. The riot started when an inmate attacked a guard. For National Public Radio, I'm Maria Gabriel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
This is National Public Radio News in Washington. Tomorrow is another grim birthday for Terry Anderson. It's the American's fifth in captivity since gunmen took him hostage in Muslim West Beirut in 1985. Anderson, a journalist and non-combatant, was kidnapped by the pro-Iranian group Islamic Jihad. His abductors have demanded the release of 15 men imprisoned in Kuwait for two bombings back in 1983. In Britain, a dispute over financial policy has ended with two resignations. Nigel Lawson, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the equivalent of the Treasury Secretary, has quit, followed by the resignation of the Prime Minister's economic adviser. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from London.
The resignation resignation of Nigel Lawson came as a surprise today. The second jolt, the resignation of Dr. Alan Walters, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's economic advisor. The two men have had a public row over economic policy for the past week. The opposition Labour Party here has used the debate to raise the question, who speaks for economic policy in Britain? The Chancellor, a government minister, or Mrs. Thatcher's economic advisor? In a raucous House of Commons debate today, Thatcher supported the Chancellor, but 2 hours later he resigned, followed by Dr. Walters. John Major has been appointed the new Chancellor. Major was named the Foreign Secretary just 2 months ago. On the foreign exchange markets today, the British pound fell sharply against the West German mark within minutes of the twin announcements. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
Italy has told Ethiopia that it's willing to host peace talks between the government and northern rebels and act as an observer. Officials of the Italian Foreign Ministry say the offer was in response to recent approaches by Ethiopia's Soviet-backed Marxist government and the rebel Tigray People's Liberation Front. The Ethiopian government has already held one round of peace talks with another rebel group. Those talks occurred last month in Atlanta, Georgia. A financial statement released by the Vatican today shows a deficit of $57 million last year. The statement made no mention of this year's financial position, but indicated that spending for modernizing the Vatican has been heavy. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Dale Willman.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Royko is one of our most popular newspaper columnists. His syndicated column appears in 525 papers. He's won dozens of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. And for 3 years in a row, he was voted America's top columnist by the readers of the Washington Journalism Review. Royko has been writing a daily column for more than 26 years in his hometown of Chicago. He gained a reputation for his affectionate portrayals of the town's ethnic neighborhoods and his biting commentaries about Chicago's public officials, in particular, the late mayor Richard Daley. Royko later went on to write a biography of Daley titled Boss. Royko's recent columns are collected in a new book called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. In one of the columns, Royko writes about a time when he was stopped at a traffic light and a teenage boy started washing the windshield of Royko's car, hoping to get a buck in return. Royko turned on the wipers to get rid of the kid and drove off in anger, but he was later angry with himself because he realized the kid needed the money.
I make a point of giving money to all panhandlers. I think by the time anybody's a panhandler, for one thing, the overhead is high. I don't like to give to charities where I read reports and find out they've spent 80% on administration and the rest goes to the poor. The one thing about a bum, if you give a bum a buck, there's no overhead. I mean, he gets the buck.
So you give money to everybody who asked you for it?
Yeah, I've never turned a panhandler down. I don't believe in it because, as I say, whether the guy's problem is that he's a drunk or that he's got a drug problem or that he's mentally addled in one way or another or he's given up on life. The only problem with that is you can't get a tax write-off.
How much change do you carry with you?
I don't give change.
You give dollars?
Yeah.
So you always carry a wad of singles?
Well, it's a good idea to carry a wad of money in a city like Chicago. Because if you're robbed and say you only have $3 on you, anybody goes to the trouble of investing in a gun and going into a line of work where you can go to prison is going to be disappointed if all he gets is a handful of quarters. So I generally carry quite a bit of money on me, so in different parts, pockets and wallets. So that I can, if I have been robbed, and I think that if they hadn't been pleased that they were showing a profit for their effort, they might have shot me. So it's a really a minor investment, giving a guy 50 or 100 bucks to avoid getting shot.
So you've been robbed a couple of times, and did you have money with you both those times?
Oh yeah, because I follow that rule. I learned that a long time ago.
Would you ever tell a mugger who you are? You know, on the odd chance that maybe they read your column and like it.
I'm not a name dropper. No.
I wonder what kind of reaction you get.
You give my card. actually, that happened in Chicago. Studs Terkel was mugged in front of his house, and the guy started wrestling with Studs. I guess Studs tried to talk to him. The guy started wrestling with him, and they wound up on the ground. And while they were wrestling around, Studs told him who he was. And the guy said, "I've heard of you. You're a writer and a well-known personality and all that and stuff. That's right. And so they had a talk, but the guy still robbed him. And but being Studs, who's a compulsive interviewer, he did get a good interview out of it. He discussed things as they were rolling around. He discussed things with the guy.
With his tape machine on?
No, he did it. No, he didn't have a tape. He was the guy would have stolen his tape.
That's right. How do you think the tone of your columns has changed over the years?
The tone hasn't really changed, I don't think. I think the subject matter has changed considerably. When I first began my column, I stuck basically with local Chicago Midwest issues, primarily Chicago issues. Chicago politics was a great deal more fun then. And Richard J. Daley was mayor. The 60s were... It was easy to write a local column in Chicago. We had most of the things that were the great social issues of the day that they were babbling about in Washington were happening in Chicago. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, every major or minor social revolution was occurring here, and most of the problems that people talked about then were here. So by writing a local column, I was actually writing, without realizing it, a national-type column, except I was at the source or at the base of the problem rather than in Washington where people put things in the Congressional Record. But as the years went on, it would have been impossible for me to just write about Chicago happenings in Chicago politics. And so the only change has been that I've broadened the base of the things I write about.
Columnist Mike Royko is my guest. He has a new collection of columns called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. You've lived in Chicago all your life. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, it was... I would say it was probably what we would call an ethnic neighborhood. It was probably about 60% Eastern European, then a mixture of Irish and Scandinavians. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. There were no... we had a lawyer, a neighborhood lawyer, and a neighborhood doctor, and a neighborhood this and that. They didn't live right in the neighborhood. They went home a mile or two away to a fancier neighborhood when the day was over. But it was basically a neighborhood where people sat on their front porches at night and had a couple firemen, a copper, and two or three taverns on the block, and a neighborhood school. It was all things considered, a fairly stable neighborhood. There wasn't much crime. There wasn't a lot of money. We were at the tail end of the Depression, and then we came out, and then we had World War II. So it wasn't a real prosperous neighborhood. Most people didn't, the majority of people didn't own a car.
I've seen your father referred to as a tavern tycoon. What kinds of bars did he run?
Well, he had a tavern. And over the years, that's where he got a tavern. It was really basically his first tavern. Later, he sold that and bought taverns in other parts of the city, trying to, you know, get a bigger and more profitable place. But that was where I grew up, was where he had his first tavern.
So your father ran one of the bars in the neighborhood?
Yeah, he had the most popular bar in the neighborhood.
How old were you when you started hanging out there?
Well, I didn't hang out so much as I swept the floor.
And, right.
Well, we lived above the tavern.
Oh.
You always did that. I mean, that you didn't have absentee tavern owners. Most taverns came with a flat in the back or a flat upstairs, so you lived there. So that was really just the first floor of my home. It's where the music came from. It's kind of nice. I developed a pretty good taste for Glenn Miller and the big bands of the era, because unlike most kids had to listen to a little radio, I had a great big jukebox downstairs.
Right. Did people treat you really well there, all the patrons of the tavern, since you were the son of the owner?
Well, I had to because I tended bar. I started tending bar when I was 12 or 13, so that was due to, in those days, taverns had very friendly relations with the police. You had local police stations, and every Saturday, the bag man, the captain's man, would come around, and I'd give him an envelope, and that assured us that if there was a fight in the tavern, they'd respond quickly, and the fact that I was only 13, they would accept my father's word that I was an elderly midget and could tend bar. I was treated well. I was more generous than my father when it came to giving them free drinks. So they liked me and the customers. And
say, how much money was in that envelope?
I never looked. It was sealed. That was a matter between my father and the local police commander, although he told me years ago, years later, one of the newspapers in Chicago opened a tavern. They had investigative reporters open a tavern and just wait to see what happens when you own a tavern in Chicago. And pretty soon people came in, building inspectors and the police and different parts of the local government seeking bribes of one kind or another. And my father was amazed when he read the story at how inflation hadn't really had that great an impact on bribes, because he told me that in the 40s he was paying more than that. And So since I didn't work on the paper that did this expose, I did a piece saying that the main thing we've seen is that the people who take bribes in Chicago are kind of dumb. They haven't really kept up with inflation.
Now, your father took bets on horses, and didn't you have to run some of the money to, to a bookie?
Well, my father, the fact that he took bets made him a bookie. Anybody who takes
bets. But you had to run into a mafia bookie, though, didn't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, because at a certain point, if you're just a small, if you're a tavern and you have but you take bets on horses or other sporting events from customers, there's a point of danger when you can't cover a large bet, or you can't cover if there's a lot of heavy betting on some event, and should you lose, you don't have the capital. And in those days, my father, today he could probably just go and go to the junk bond people and borrow several million dollars and cover it, but in those days, if you couldn't pay off, you'd have trouble. You know, like your legs might get broken. So it was a routine. You would go to the big bookie. You weren't operating without the big bookie's permission in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just take the overflow or the big bets and lay them off with the big guy because he could cover them. And it was his responsibility, since you were also paying him a fee, a franchise fee, in effect, to stay in business.
So what? Yeah.
Really does sound like basic American businesses today. You know, for you, bookies were franchised, and you go to the guy with them, and instead of going to Wall Street for the extra dough, you go to a syndicate guy down the street who is probably just as honest.
Well, did you or your father, though, ever get into any trouble with the mafia?
Oh, no. My father used to go to the Kentucky Derby for a year with these people. They were nice people. Most of them are. They rarely get involved in violence. That really, they try to avoid that. They're not like the modern Scarface, Al Pacino type criminals who go around shooting up the joint at the drop of an insult. Nor are they glamorous, operatic type figures, as in Coppola's movies, The Godfather saga. But they're just ordinary thugs who are just making a living.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is syndicated columnist Mike Royko, and he's been writing a column in his hometown of Chicago for over 26 years. A collection of his recent columns are in the book, Dr. Kooky, You're Right. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist Mike Royko is my guest. When you started tending bar when you were 12 years old, what was some of the advice your father gave you about when to talk to a customer and when to just be quiet and when, if ever, to stop serving a customer if they were really drunk or if they were causing trouble?
I don't recall his ever having to give me any advice because I had grown up in the atmosphere, before I attended bar, my job was sweeping up, and I sort of absorbed it. There really isn't that complicated to attend bar in a neighborhood tavern. You didn't have to know how to make a martini. I don't think anybody ever ordered one. The standard drinks were a shot or a beer or a shot and a beer. Women generally had a highball, just a shot of bourbon with some ginger ale in it. I don't recall anybody ever asking for champagne or a pink lady or anything, a daiquiri. I think my father would have told them, why don't you go to a Spanish neighborhood if you want a daiquiri, whatever that is. We just didn't have, it was a very easy job. Anybody could tend bar.
Do you think it's helped you as a columnist to have grown up around a tavern?
Well, it helped me as a Chicago columnist, I think, to have grown up in Chicago. When I wrote 1971, I published a book on sort of an unauthorized biography, or really not a biography, just sort of a subjective view of Richard J. Daley and the city and the political machine. And when people ask me when I started researching the book, I said, yeah, I probably started research about when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I started understanding how things worked in this city. And I was well into my research by the time I was handing the sergeant the envelope. And if you grow up in a town, it helps a lot when you write, if you're going to write about it.
Mm-hmm. But have you ever consciously gone to hang out at a bar, specifically just to overhear a conversation, see what people were talking about?
No, actually not. I don't go in that many bars. I'm at a point in life where I can't do my work and sit around in bars. It's just only so many hours in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what they're saying. Right this week, they're probably saying that Mike Ditka was stupid to trade McMahon, and they're saying that William Perry is fat and ought to be traded, and that's about what they're saying, probably in those bars.
Mm-hmm. Were there columns that you wrote early on that got you into trouble with City Hall that really aggravated the people in City Hall early on in your career?
Oh, well, yeah. When Richard J. Daley was mayor of Chicago, I was probably his major adversary, which showed what a cushy deal he had. I was better known than the people who ran against him, and I gave him more grief than the people who ran against him. And but someone had to do it, and he was fun. He was fun to write about. The machine. See, the papers had never really covered, as far as I was concerned, the real politics in Chicago, and they had never described the people in politics in Chicago. the way they should have been. And I started going to city council meetings and taking recorders with me. And then I would print exactly what aldermen said. And people would say to me, "My God, that was a great expose." just quoting them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started going to Mayor Daley's press conferences and doing the same thing and quoting him precisely. And that was fun for a while. I did a number of columns. But then the press secretary said that if I didn't stop, he'd stop holding press conferences. So the press corps in City Hall pleaded with me, "Go away, or we will be cut off from the source of information." But I kind of pioneered the realism of Chicago politics, and I recall with some relish in 1968, a week before the convention, I wrote a column about what the Democrats could expect when they came to Chicago in 1968, what kind of guy Daley was, and what the machine was like. And I believe it was the L.A. Times, which got my column over our wire at the time, rejected. They didn't want to print that. Instead, they got a guy in Chicago, a college professor, to write a piece on Daley, and it was a very laudatory piece on how he was misunderstood, et cetera, et cetera. And after the L.A. Times stopped paying the hospital bills for all the reporters who got whacked on the head that they had here, after the convention, one of the editors told me, he says, "I think we made a mistake. I think maybe we should have printed your piece instead." People didn't understand Chicago politics. Even a lot of Chicagoans didn't. So if I made any contribution with my column in Chicago, that was about it.
How do you think Chicago politics have changed?
Oh, it's more conventional now. It's closer to being politics as it is in other cities. With the added ingredient of race, but that's we're not the first to have that. And it's changed because there is no longer a dominant political machine. That's changed for a number of reasons, primarily legal decisions that have almost killed off about 98% of all political patronage. When Daley became mayor, he controlled a minimum of 40,000 jobs. And a rule of thumb in Chicago is that each job is worth a minimum of 10 votes automatic. So you had this gigantic machine with loyalty to one guy, ultimately, the Daley, who was both the mayor and the head of the party. That's changed.
Mm-hmm.
Today. You've got two parties in Chicago. You have the White Party and the Black Party.
You think it divides that clearly?
It couldn't be divided any more clearly than that.
Of all the columns you've written over the years, can you single out any one of them as having the most impact?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I can't. But that's not why I do a column. I do columns because I think that at some point in the newspaper, somebody should be able to stop, take a breather, and get a laugh. And that's basically what I try to do with my columns. I don't try to take things, even when I try to take things seriously, I try to write them in such a way that the reader will go away with at least having a laugh once or twice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your columns and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mike Royko, and his syndicated column originates at the Chicago Tribune. Some recent columns have been collected in the new book, Dr. Kooky, You're Right. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Jean-Michel Cousteau. He's spent his life exploring the ocean with his father, Jacques Cousteau, and he's written many books, articles, and produced TV programs on his many journeys. His latest book follows a trip to Papua New Guinea. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. For about 30 years, Jacques d'Amboise was a principal dancer with George Balanchine's New York City Ballet. As that career was ending, d'Amboise embarked on a second one, teaching kids to dance. Coming up, Jacques d'Amboise tells us about going from a street gang to the ballet to the schools. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent recording featuring Sir Michael Tippett conducting his own works. And who's Europe's biggest film star right now? He doesn't have many lines, he doesn't use makeup, and he's not human. Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Bear. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The former Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Samuel Pierce, has informed a congressional committee that he will take the Fifth Amendment again when he appears before the panel tomorrow. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
Pierce has been subpoenaed to appear before a congressional panel to testify about mismanagement and political favoritism at HUD during the Reagan years. Today, he informed the committee that he would invoke his constitutional right not to testify, and he asked the committee to cancel the session. The committee has refused. Pierce appeared under subpoena once before. He took the Fifth Amendment at that time also. Pierce has invoked a House of Representatives rule that bars television cameras and tape recorders from the hearing room while he is testifying. An attempt by several news organizations to overturn that rule has been unsuccessful, so tomorrow, when Pierce appears before the committee, he will be invisible as well as silent. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush proposed today legislation allowing pesticides to be taken off the market more quickly. The plan, attacked in advance by environmentalists as a step backward in some areas, would overhaul pesticide regulation laws enforced by the Environmental Protection Agency and the Food and Drug Administration. Secretary of the Treasury Nicholas Brady today endorsed a package of stock market reforms aimed at calming the stock market when trading gets volatile. NPR's John Itzde reports.
The package of reforms includes a provision that would give the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, the power to suspend trading on the stock exchanges during times of major market disturbance. The SEC chairman doesn't want the power. He wants it to remain with the president. Secretary Brady disagrees. He says looking to the president to close the markets during a crisis would add to the turmoil.
Giving that power to the chairman in conjunction with the full commission really makes it less of a dramatic event and one that should be exercised at a level underneath the president.
The market reform package endorsed today by Brady also includes provisions that would provide regulators with more information about big market traders. It would also improve the method of settling market transactions so the markets would function more smoothly. I'm John Itzde in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell charged today that a new move by Republicans to cut the capital gains tax could delay or even kill an effort by Congress to provide aid to Poland and Hungary. Meanwhile, Republicans say that they are determined to force the capital gains issue to an up or down vote to redeem one of President Bush's principal campaign promises. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 39.5 points to close at 2,613.73 on volume of some 177 million shares. Declining issues led advances 3-1 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Sir Michael Tippett is generally considered the greatest living British composer. He's visiting the U.S. this week as a resident at the New England Conservatory. His fifth opera, New Year, has its world premiere in Houston this Friday night. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about Tippett and a recent recording in which he conducts his own works.
You have to admire the music of Sir Michael Tippett, who is now, at the age of 84, the elder statesman of British composers. He's worked in all the major musical forms, from intimate chamber music to large symphonic and choral works to grand opera. And he's literary, too. He writes his own librettos. Some of his music I find extremely beautiful and moving, but some of it seems to demand rather than earn your admiration. with its portentous pronouncements about life with a capital L. When he tries to make his characters universal, they seem more like stereotypes than archetypes. Tippett's largest oratorio, The Mask of Time, which was commissioned by the Boston Symphony in 1984, seems like a patchwork of clichés. His libretto quotes just about everything from Milton and Shelley to Jacob Bronowski's The Ascent of Man. His Third Symphony leans too heavily and obviously on Beethoven's Ninth. Tippett sees T.S. Eliot as a role model for his own allusiveness. But Tippett's many references sometimes seem more like a matter of style than like Eliot's compulsive need to call up the random images haunting him. One of Tippett's most moving works is his early oratorio, A Child of Our Time, with its gorgeous settings of familiar spirituals. But Tippett's later dabbling in such non-classical idioms as boogie-woogie and American slang can be embarrassingly self-conscious.
Walk that walk. Talk that talk. Moods we ain't got, but guitars aplenty. The living language of our time is urban.
That was a section of the autobiographical Songs for Dove, an offshoot of Tippett's 1970 opera The Knot Garden, in which Dove, a young homosexual musician, discovers the nature and function of being an artist. What saves Tippett is that however uneven the work, there is always some wonderfully evocative and atmospheric music. Here, flute, harp, and electric guitar introduce a line that Tippett quotes from Ariel's song in The Tempest. This performance comes from a superb compact disc that was released last year on the Virgin Classics label. Nigel Robeson is the tenor, and the Scottish Chamber Orchestra is conducted by Sir Michael himself. There are also two earlier works on the album. The Concerto for Double String Orchestra was completed in 1939. The even more beautiful Fantasia Concertante on a theme of Corelli may be Tippett's orchestral masterpiece. It dates from 1953, the 300th anniversary of the birth of Arcangelo Corelli. Tippett uses two contrasting themes from a Corelli concerto grosso, adagio and vivace. He calls them the dark and the light.
Thank you.
This work begins with a series of increasingly complex variations on these themes. Then there's a large-scale, free-flowing contrapuntal fantasia, in which Tippett uses not only the Corelli themes, but a Bach organ fugue based on a theme of Corelli. With stirring intensity, Tippett transforms all this borrowed material into one of his most personal and powerful musical statements. Here, he earns your admiration, and more.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a Virgin Classics recording of music by Sir Michael Tippett. This is Fresh Air. For more than 30 years, Jacques d'Amboise was a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. But in recent years, he's become best known as a dance teacher. His students are children from New York's public schools. His National Dance Institute reaches 27 schools and culminates each June in a big citywide performance. A 1984 documentary about d'Amboise called He Makes Me Feel Like Dancing won an Academy Award. D'Amboise was 7 when he first started to dance. I asked him if boys that age today think dance classes are for sissies.
They're suspicious of ballet, not dance. They've seen, John Travolta and breakdancing and Michael Jackson. That's fantastic. But they're suspicious of ballet because they think ballet, they have to wear their sister's leotards and dress in dressing rooms with lots of gay dancers. And they're all uptight about that.
Well, are you teaching ballet or?
No, I don't teach. Yeah. I teach ballet once in a while, but it's not ballet. You can't see ballet. When I go to the schools, and I start right away by saying, you're not going to learn ballet because you're not good enough. People who do ballet are special. They devote their life to it. They want to learn to fly in the air and leap and have no noise when they land. They're special. And I said, we're going to do freestyle jazz. You need sloppy clothes and sneakers. You have to have lots of energy. And it's going to be, you don't have to wear your sister's leotard.
You audition the children to see if they can be in your classes. How do you audition kids who don't have any formal dance training yet?
Well, first of all, I have teachers. I'm not doing all these classes. I could never get to all these classes. So the teachers audition, and occasionally I come through like a circuit rider. The way they pick it and the way I pick it when I'm there, who tries the hardest? Not who's the best. Who tries the hardest? For 1 hour, you're giving steps to children, and they don't know their right from their left, and you're demanding excellence, and you're demanding silence, and no chewing gum, and no bad manners, and no fighting, and no foul language, and stand straight, and lift your head up, and put your right foot front, and do it on the music, and now twice as fast, and so on. And you can see the lurkers over in the back and the side, that kind of hands in their pocket, and they're kind of giggling and laughing. Get rid of them right away. Tell them that they're not ready yet, next year when they're ready. So it's those that try.
Well, what kind of line do you like to walk between fun and discipline? And what I mean by that is I'm sure you want, your students to be as disciplined as possible and to dance as well as possible. On the other hand, I don't know how much pressure you want to put on them, so that they worry about not living up to expectations.
There is a thing called precision. There's a thing called editing. Being precise and knowing how to edit. And that's the secret of being creative. So I'll start by saying to a class, an auditorium full of children, I'll say, I want the first 3 rows to stand up and quietly go to the stage, spread out on the stage, stand everywhere, fill every inch of space, the smallest people in the front, the tallest in the back. Now, here it is. I tell them they have 10 seconds, exactly 10 seconds to do this, to fill those 10 seconds. Three rows of children, 30 children, get up and run yelling and screaming to the stage and end up all in lines in the back, right? And they all get there within 3 or 4 seconds. Then I said, number one, I asked you to do it quietly. Number two, you're supposed to fill every inch of the space, and the stage is 40 by 40, so you have to be all over it, staggered, the shorter people front. And I said 10 seconds. You were there in 3. You must take 10, not 9, not 8, 10. And now go back and do it again. And if I have to call you a third time, I won't teach this class. Now, the second time they get it, it's absolutely quiet. They get to their place, and they take all 10 seconds. They get there early. They'll walk in little circles until the 10 seconds are up. The countdown's over. They freeze. They get it. And then I say, you just learn what dance is about. It controls time, and it controls space. You control time, and you control space with your body, you. And that's the first thing that dance. You just began to dance.
Let's talk about how you started dancing. How did you start to dance?
Well, my mother was determined that her children not be bums in the street and trouble. So when my sister went to a ballet class, I was dragged along, made to sit and watch Madame Setter up on 181st in St. Nicholas. And this is 1942, and I tried to disrupt the class. I'd make noise, little sounds, little squeaks, and play with the rosin. And Madame Setter was very smart. She just watched, and then at the end of class, there are these leaps, jumps that you do consecutively called changement or changes. And she said, you, with all your energy and fiddling, can you do this? Can you jump as high as the girls? Get up and try this. So I'd get up and do the jumps, and I loved doing the jumps. Everybody applauded me, and I'd leap and leap and leap. So she says, every day, if you sit there quietly, I'll let you do the jumps. So I'd sit there waiting for the jumps. Then she said, but you make noise when you land. So you have to take the beginning of class where you practice the pliés or where you begin to get the strength and learn how to come out of the air and land. So I'd do the beginning of class. I'd run and sit waiting for the end. Then she said, you look sloppy in the air. You've got to learn how to hold your body and your arms, point your feet. You've got to take the middle of the climb. By then I was ready. So she did exactly. She challenged you, test you, set up the environment of excellence, and congratulated you when you succeeded and made it harder. She did everything right.
You've run into a lot of your boy students who are a little uncomfortable about being possibly associated with ballet. What about you when you were young? Did your friends give you a hard time about it? Were you embarrassed about it yourself?
No, not one little bit. Because, you see, I would absolutely be down there dancing and seeing great dances. And I'd come back around the block, and it'd all be waiting. Where you been? We hear you went to a dancing class. And I said, yes, and it's great. There's this man with all these muscles, and he leaps in the air, and he doesn't make noise, and he does all these turns, Andrei Glevsky. And he does these double tours, and he does like this. And on a street corner in front of Dave's Candy Shop on 163rd in St. Nicholas, I started dancing and getting all my gang to try and do double tours and things. No problem. And then when I got in New York City Ballet, I was 15, they'd sneak down to City Center, 25 gang members. And I'd go out and I'd open the fire escape. And they'd come up at half hour and I'd let them in the balcony. See? And so I'd come on in the court of ballet of Symphony and C. There were eight boys and men in the court of ballet and one teenager, me. And all up from the balcony, whistles and screams every time I'd come on stage. And, you know, they'd all know that my gang was out front. You know?
Was there a moment for you when you knew, this is it, I am now going to retire from performing?
Yes.
What was that moment?
First injuries, and serious injuries, and in the hospital, and a doctor saying, that's it, you're not going to dance again. But Balanchine was saying, no, you have to come back. I need you. You have to come back. So I went back and danced, and sure enough, a year later, I had another operation. Well, then I said, wait a minute. Balanchine's so extraordinary, and he's fading, and I'm fading. I'm just going to stay and dance as long as I can. with him, and meanwhile I'll start National Dance Institute, right, this thing with the children. So I began to dance, but roles started, you know, out of 60 ballets I'd do 50, because the minute I'd do something badly or didn't like it, I'd drop it. Until finally, 1984, it just was no good. I had two ballets left that I felt I could dance, and I didn't like it anymore. And the effort of getting on stage was too painful. And I thought, I don't belong here anymore. So I quit. And I don't even remember who that person was that used to dance. When I look at old films or see people do my roles, I can hardly remember who is that person.
Why
that
not?
Used to dance.
Why is it so hard to remember?
It's like somebody else. I've become somebody else. It's not, my body can't move that way anymore. I don't even feel like I was a dancer like that. It's somebody else. I look at it and I say, it's another person. See?
Well, when you do look at somebody dancing one of the ballets that you did, what emotional response do you have? Is it, oh, that's nice, someone carrying it on, or is it envy that they can still dance and you can't?
No, I don't like anybody doing my roles. No, what happens is I look at them dancing, and unless they do something special for it that excites me and thrills me, I don't like ballet. I know it so well. I know everything about it. There are a few dancers, male dancers, that I still love to see, but they better be good. Otherwise, I've seen the best. I don't want to see anything second rate.
Well, Jacques d'Amboise, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about dance.
Terry, a pleasure.
Jacques d'Amboise directs the National Dance Institute in New York City. This is Fresh Air. Let's check in with Linda Wertheimer and see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're planning a half-hour piece tonight on All Things Considered from Danny Zwerdling, who used to report from Washington but has now moved to Nairobi and is reporting from Kenya. He has a piece on the death of a British tourist, which took place in the Masai Mara, the game preserve. The Kenyan government says the woman was killed by wild animals. Her family believes she was murdered, and the mystery is a major issue in Kenya today. We're also going to talk about the cost of the California earthquake and compare and contrast a bit the quake that took place in California with one that occurred just a few days later in China.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Move over, Benji and Elsa the Lion. There are two new furry faces starring in the film The Bear. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
The most disturbing thing about The Bear is the way it reveals what movies are in all their nakedness. Who needs a multi-layered plot, rich characters, complex issues, or sinuous dialogue? Those are all just so much icing on the crowd-pleasing cake. The Bear is one of the most enormous international hits in history, and it's achieved its position using the creakiest of old Hollywood come-ons. A simple chase plot, some pretty scenery, and most important of all, two glamorous and beautiful stars. The kind that, like Madonna or Cher, require only one name. Meet Bart. And Deuce. The movie has only 44 lines of dialogue, most of it grunted by three fairly lousy actors who play bear hunters. The hunter's quarry is Big Bart, a gorgeous Kodiak whom they've already wounded. But they also capture Little Deuce, an orphan cub who spends most of the movie trying to get Bart to love and care for him. That, more or less, is the whole plot. But the director takes us inside the bear's heads in a daring way that's by turns affecting and icky sweet. In almost no instance, however, is it believable. Giving bears simple and comprehensible human emotions wipes out their mystery. Making them big, dumb, furry versions of ourselves turns them into the sort of critters Goldilocks might have felt at home around. The soundtrack, which is wonderfully designed, makes the bear sound even more anthropomorphic. Here's Little Deuce whimpering. I could swear no bear on earth sounds that appealingly human and baby-like. And even when he tries to scare the hunters away, he sounds more like Flipper in a snit. Here's a kind of bear happy hour. Sounds like fun, doesn't it? How about this? Right, not a bear, a frog. But I digress. The movie's director, Jean-Jacques Annaud, made Quest for Fire, the glossy but irremediably dumb spectacle about how cavemen are just like you and me. In some ways, the bear goes even further. We get to see bear dreams, for instance. And in one scene, little Deuce eats some questionable mushrooms and has a little ursine acid trip. All of this keeps the time passing, divertingly enough, but I kept wishing this movie had more grit, more edge. The bear is some kind of technical feat, but what it does to nature is denature it. At heart, this movie is Bambi, with claws.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Vablitis, Dan Laughlin, and Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jean-Michel Cousteau tells us about exploring the ocean in the tradition of his famous father. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Linda Ronstadt and Kate Bush. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.